Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today, a little bit later in this episode, I'm sitting down once again with Adam Harris, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's written some interesting books and articles over the years, including one about why colleges have always been unequal. Before The Atlantic, he was at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He is an education expert, and today we're going to talk about the role of private equity in the childcare industry and just the overall crisis in childcare within this country. We kind of zoom out also just to talk about private equity generally. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about what we learned this week in the 2024 elections. So Haley dropped out, Dean Phillips dropped out. We are now officially in the general election. And one thing that I'm going to do consistently once a month on this podcast is update an index to say, well, how is this race going for each of the two major candidates, Trump versus Biden, in this what is likely to be the longest and nastiest general election campaign in history. And I have come up with 10 questions that are going to be the top 10 key questions that are going to matter in this election. And what I'm going to do in this podcast is I'm going to go through and explain each of these questions. And I'm going to tell you at this moment, which of these questions is answered in a way at this moment that will help Trump or help Biden or neither of them. And then I'll give you a tally. And what we'll do is every month we'll update our thinking on these to say, well, okay, who's winning the election right now? Even beyond the pollings. You know, the polling we know right now, which is that Trump has an advantage. The betting markets give Trump an advantage. But what are the long-term trends in this race, or short and medium-term trends that are going to play out from now until November? And so we've got 10 of them, and I'm going to do them in reverse order. So meaning we're going to end with the most important trends, and we're going to start with the trends that are less important, but all 10 of them are on here for a reason. All of these are important trends. So number 10 question for this election is, what impact will global issues have on this campaign? And we've got two big ones. We've got Israel-Palestine and the negotiations over a ceasefire. The New York Times Siena poll came over the weekend, which I'm going to quote a lot from in this segment, showed that 40% of voters said they sympathize more with Israel compared to 24% who said they sympathize more with Palestinians. Trump was winning 70% of those who backed Israel primarily. Biden's winning 68% of those who sided with the Palestinians. Although obviously he's faced a major challenge in the uncommitted vote, which was in the double digits in certain states like Michigan and Minnesota. So he's got a real challenge on his hands there. There's also these negotiations over Ukraine aid and the prospect of Ukraine collapsing. That, I would say, is a little bit messier of a picture. I think if Ukraine collapses, one school of thought would say it just contributes to the Biden chaos narrative, or Biden's weak and, you know, the world was quiet under Trump narrative that I hear from a lot of people. Or it could make Trump and some of the conservatives who've been holding up Ukraine aid look bad, because one could argue that the United States not standing by Ukraine and continuing to support them would have been a factor there. I would say, though, that in the end right now, as things stand, this whole body of stuff, global issues, benefits Trump. And I would say this is especially true because the dynamics of the Israel-Palestinian conflict debate are really harming Biden's ability to consolidate the base right now, in part because of what we're learning with this uncommitted vote. So advantage Trump on that question. Question number 9, will the border situation improve or deteriorate between now and the election? One thing to keep in mind is we're seeing all these numbers about all these increases in border crossings and interactions between the apprehensions between the U.S. and people trying to cross. One thing to keep in mind is these border crossings actually increase as the weather gets warmer and we get more into the summer. July, I think, typically is our biggest month for crossing, so it could get way worse. A new Wall Street Journal survey that just came out this morning showed that 59% of voters said they would support the bipartisan package, with roughly equal percentages of Republicans and Democrats in favor of the package. Wow. An even larger share, 74%, support creating a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who've been in the country for many years and can pass a background check. 66% of voters said they supported creating a mechanism to grant citizenship to children, the DACA type of stuff, the Dreamers. 58% supported increasing the level of legal immigration in the U.S. The poll found that 70% of voters rank immigration as their top issue, and that's up from 13% in December. So an increase of people saying it's their top issue, but it's a little nuanced. So you got equal parts Democrats and Republicans saying it's their top issue, and you have people with really high numbers supporting solutions beyond restriction. So increased illegal immigration, increased protections for Dreamers, granting citizenship or permanent residency to people who've been here for a while. That is fascinating. I still call this an advantage to Trump, though, because some 45% of people in the survey felt like Biden had allowed more illegal immigration by reversing some of Trump's executive orders. 39% said that Republicans killed the Senate deal and blamed Trump and the Republicans for that. So 45-39, I give it as a slight advantage to Trump on this issue, in part because historically, immigration is an issue that tends to favor Republicans if it's an issue that voters care a lot about. Although I would say this is shaky ground for Republicans given what they did on the border deal and the fact that they did it so brazenly, something that Carlos and I talked about on Tuesday, and the numbers are reflecting that. Those numbers are getting closer and closer together, and that is not a good thing for Republicans. Question number nine, the role of third-party candidates. What role will they play? Nikki Haley has ruled out a No Labels run, but No Labels just announced that they plan to move forward with a slate of candidates. RFK Jr.'s campaign said Tuesday that they've cleared the signature threshold in Nevada and that their PAC has already had sufficient signatures in Arizona and Georgia. All the while, the DNC has filed a complaint against RFK Jr. with the Federal Elections Commission, alleging that the campaign illegally coordinated with his PAC to secure ballot access. That could be trouble for Kennedy if there's any truth to those allegations. But almost every poll I've seen shows that most of the conceivable third-party candidates would help Trump in this election. So this one is an advantage to Trump. So if you're counting, that's 3 for 3 advantages for Trump in the questions that we have so far. Question number 7, will Biden maintain his cash advantage? Put another way, who's going to raise the most money and will it matter? The Biden campaign announced Tuesday morning that they raised $42 million in January. This is adding to a vast, vast fundraising advantage they have over Trump and the RNC. So according to Bloomberg, groups allied with Biden have already committed to spend more than $700 million to help beat Trump in the 2024 election. Biden's reelection campaign now has $130 million in addition to the outside spending in the bank. The RNC, in contrast, started the year with over $8 million cash on hand. I don't have their updated January numbers yet, but Trump's campaign started the year with $33 million cash on hand, but they reported in January that they spent more than they took in January. So they have less than $33 million, while Biden has $130 million. So Biden has almost $100 million cash advantage. As historical context, Biden was the first candidate in U.S. history to raise more than $1 billion. In 2020, that was compared to $774 million to Trump. So he had more than Trump, but it wasn't like an ass-kicking in the fundraising world. But Trump did face a cash crunch in the weeks leading up to the election year, which forced him to pull back on advertising and spending. That may have made a huge difference in the end. We can expect under these current trends that this is going to be one of the most lopsided fundraising environments that we've ever seen. Now, whether it matters or not, I think is going to be up to the Biden campaign to spend their money wisely and the outside groups, but also with Trump having significant legal issues and dipping into campaign coffers to pay for those, this is not a good dynamic for Trump. So this is a huge advantage to Biden. Question number 6, will either candidate face a health crisis before the election? CBS News had a poll a few months ago that showed that 34% of respondents thought Biden would complete a second term and only 55% thought Trump would. So 34, basically, two-thirds of respondents don't think Biden would finish his second term, and about half didn't think Trump would. It's not great in general, but this is less an issue, I would say, electoral perception than the reality. Like in these next few months, statistically, there's at least a decent chance. It's not a 50% plus chance. It's way smaller than that, but that something major could happen given we're dealing with two fairly advanced folks here that could completely upend this race. I call this a tie because we don't really have any information to know which of the two candidates it would affect. Question number 5, who will Trump pick as his VP and will it matter? Oddsmaker.com puts Kristi Noem as the favorite at plus 400, Tim Scott at plus 800 at second, Vivek at plus 860 in third, and Lee Stefanik at plus 1100 in fourth. These are interesting candidates. The question is, will it help Trump? Will it matter? I call this an advantage to Trump because it's just an opportunity to inject into the race a new name with new energy. And I think the electorate is just I think we'll be excited to see anybody new and younger and more vigorous in this race. I suspect it's going to be Noam or Scott, and those two have certain advantages with certain key constituencies, whether it's women or the African-American vote, which we'll get to. Noam's going to be double-edged sword, I think, because of, you know, we talk about appealing to women voters, but we talk about one of the most animating issues right now, and in Dobbs, IVF, those types of issues is not going to be great. But I do think that this VP is an opportunity to change the conversation, signal youth and change. Given that people don't think that Biden or Trump are going to finish the term, it would basically say, all right, this is a person who could potentially be president in the next 4 years. And Harris is not very popular, so this would be a good contrast for them. This is an advantage for Trump. Question number four, will Biden be able to achieve his 2020 performance with communities of color? As a reminder, 87% of 2020 Black voters supported Biden and 66% of Hispanic voters. On Tuesday, we already talked about how Biden's already underwater with Hispanic voters, with at least in some polls, Trump having an advantage there. That is really bad for Biden. The New York Times Siena poll from this weekend showed Trump's support among Black voters has spiked to 23%. And according to the Times Siena poll, 26% of Black voters surveyed responded that they'd personally been helped more by Trump's policies than Biden's. In comparison, only 17% said they'd benefited from Biden's policies. That is really bad for Biden. You can imagine that that billion plus dollars is probably going to be spent on Biden's team, maybe $2 billion, is going to be spent on messaging to his core constituencies to even get him back to where he was in 2020. What's fascinating here is that Biden never had the kind of turnout within these constituencies that Obama had. I think it could get even worse here. What's fascinating here to think about, though, is Trump has a base too, right? And how is Trump doing with his base? Now, here's a question to ask yourself. What do you see as more likely? Trump picking up additional support within the Black community, which I think would be, that would essentially end Biden's chances if Trump picks up 5, 10% within the Black community, because the margins here really matter. So what do we think is more likely? That Trump picks up more support within the Black community, which these polls are suggesting he could, or that Biden picks up support within non-college educated whites, which is Trump's base. I think that's pretty obvious. I do not see a path for Biden at the moment to pick up significant support among non-college educated whites, but Trump certainly has room to grow here within the Black community. But it's also worth mentioning that Trump has to make up some ground just demographically. So you can't just take 2020 as the sort of terrain that we're operating in. Because of rising growth rates of non-white voters and other ethnic groups, increased educational attainment of younger voters, and just the demographic numbers of older white voters being replaced by younger, more diverse college-educated voters, the share of non-college white has been shrinking continuously election after election. So Trump actually does need to play a little bit of defense there. But in the end, this is advantage Trump, I think, in part because of what we see with the Hispanic vote and the Black vote. The numbers aren't looking good at the moment there for Biden. Question number three, this is a related question. Will turnout dip generally? And if it does, who does it help or hurt more? So there's one school of thought that says low turnout races help Democrats. And this has been true of midterm elections and special elections because Democrats rely more on college-educated voters who tend to turn out more in these sort of off-year elections. Those voters have also been animated by Dobbs. But in the general elections, when Trump has been on the ballot, turnout has spiked. In 2020, turnout was massive. 66 to 67% of voters cast a ballot. This is the highest turnout since 1992. Both Democratic-leaning and Republican-leaning groups saw a huge turnout. But the biggest turnout increase was actually among non-college educated whites, who, you know, obviously are Trump's base. That group's turnout was 64%, which was its highest rate since at least 2000. And that helped Trump keep it closer than it otherwise would have been. There were also increases in, even from 2016 to 2020, among Asian Americans, Hispanic and Latino voters. So those voters will loom large. But obviously, as I mentioned, if there's increased and sustained turnout among Hispanics, but they go for Trump, that turns into an advantage for him. Another additional dark cloud for Biden is that young voters cast the highest rate of participation in 2020 than in any election so far this century. And those voters are not very enthusiastic for Biden right now. He could face some major issues there. And there's just a general enthusiasm gap. The New York Times Siena poll over the weekend showed that among all likely voters, only 23% of Democratic primary voters were enthusiastic about Biden, and about half of Republicans said they were enthusiastic about Trump. So basically double Republicans are enthusiastic about Trump. Significantly more Democrats said they were either dissatisfied or angry at Biden as their leader than about Trump. So this is a bit major problem for Biden. So this is an advantage for Trump. Question number two, will the economy hold steady, improve, or retract? And how will voters perceive that? A lot of data from places like Pew and the University of Michigan, which a lot of economists trust as like one of the, if not the most important long-term sort of survey on economic sentiment. They show positive signs for Democrats. In the Siena poll, among registered voters, 26% of voters believe the economy is good or excellent. And this is up 6% since July. So not a massive spike, but an increase. But that movement occurred disproportionately among older Democrats, who's a constituency that's most likely to vote for Biden. Nearly two-thirds of registered voters rated the price of food and other consumer goods as poor. And so those are issues for Democrats. The unemployment rate, so what Democrats will say is all these trends are economic trends that have been moving in the positive direction. The unemployment rate has been under 4% for 2 years, and the stock market has been showing records. And that 40% of people surveyed said the economy overall was worse than a year earlier. But when you ask people about their own economic situation, a majority of people rate their own situation as good or excellent. And those numbers are climbing. And so the Democrats will say, all right, personally, people are feeling better about their own economic situation, and the broader economic numbers are looking better, and voters are going to internalize that. That's their hope. And it's a good thing to remind the audience here that the overall economic news, not just from right-wing media, had been negative for so long. So in October 2022, Bloomberg Economics forecasted the probability of a recession within a year at 100%. And even by mid-2023, banks like Deutsche Bank put the risk of a recession at 100%. So that's very near term. And numbers lately have been positive. So if you look at the way progressives are messaging on this, this is from the Center for American Progress. They said, quote, in 2023, real gross domestic product grew 3.1%, beating expectations amid persistent global economic uncertainties. Most notably, last year, the U.S. GDP grew faster than that of every country in the group of seven, which includes the seven of the world's most advanced economies. Notably, the U.K. and Japan ended 2023 in a technical recession, while the United States continued to experience the G7's strongest economic recovery from COVID-19. And the U.S. ended 2023 with headline inflation and core inflation at 3.4% and 3.9% respectively. These are among the lowest rates in the G7. They also point to the fact that the gap between black and white unemployment rates has reached a record low in 2023. So that's what the progressives are going to be saying. They're going to message that. My sense is the relentless barrage of money from Biden, and also the fact that a lot of people in the media, I think, are going to be singing more positive economic news if the numbers continue to head in that direction. I think this is an advantage for Biden, in part because it's hard to imagine them going lower than what they were. He only really has room to go up. And then the final, most important question of this election cycle is, will Trump see a verdict? And will, if he's convicted, will he go to prison? Why do I say this is the most important question? Because literally, if it goes the wrong way for Trump, he will not have his freedom. And a lot of polls suggest that voters will have an issue with a convicted felon on the ballot. Now, would they change their minds once it happens because of how the verdict may be seen, especially if it's something like the Bragg case, which is harder to sell? Only time will tell. 53% of voters in that same New York Times Siena poll, which showed Trump leading Biden, somehow, even though that Trump's leading Biden, a majority of voters, 53% of voters, believe Trump committed serious federal crimes. I think that's an interesting combination. So there's some segment of voters who think he committed serious federal crimes, but still want to vote for him. This is going to play out, obviously, in the next few months. I talked about this last week. There was one interesting wrinkle that I didn't mention on the last podcast when I talked about the legal issues, is that in the Friday hearing down in Florida over the documents case in front of Aileen Cannon, the lawyers on Jack Smith's team, they talked about their interpretation of the so-called 60-day rule, which is this Department of Justice internal guideline that says that they don't indict or do significant legal activity, depending on how you interpret it, within 60 days of the election. This was the rule that many people criticized Comey for potentially violating when he made that announcement of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. The Jack Smith team, I think, had a pretty loose definition of the 60-day rule in this hearing, and they said essentially that the policy doesn't apply to cases that have already been indicted and are being currently litigated. Translation, they can see hearings and trials going all the way up until election day. That's how they're interpreting the 60-day rule. That's notable because that could affect the Aileen Cannon case. It could affect the insurrection case in D.C. that is hinging on the Supreme Court's decision. So that is fascinating. But then you also have, as I mentioned in the last podcast, the Bragg case, which is set for jury selection later this month. That case will see a verdict in all likelihood this spring. And then the question is, will the appeals play out in time for the election? Chances are probably that there's a verdict, but that if it's a conviction, Trump may be able to run out the clock and not be incarcerated by election day, which would set up, if he won the election, a really awful circumstance for the country, which is the president of the United States facing jail time within a state, prison time within a state. And how do we handle that? I don't know. But this is advantage Biden, because Biden is not facing criminal prosecution. Trump is. This is pretty much only a risk for Trump. I mean, obviously, there's the argument that he can play the victim and all that. But I would say you'd rather not have a bunch of criminal prosecutions hanging over your head than you would. And also, this is draining his campaign coffers. So if you're, those are all 10 questions. This is a 6-3-1 advantage for Trump right now. So six of these questions right now are looking better for Trump than Biden, three better for Biden than Trump, and one is a tie. So right now, this race is much more likely to go to Trump, in my estimation, based on these trends, than to Biden. We'll keep updating this every month. And with that, let's get to Adam Harris from The Atlantic. He wrote this article called Private Equity Has Its Eyes on the Childcare Industry. Let's get to it. Well, Adam, welcome back to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I found your piece in The Atlantic really fascinating about the role of private equity in childcare. Taking a step back, we're going to link in our show notes to prior segments we've done on private equity in general. But why don't we just define our terms a little bit here? When we talk about private equity, what is that?
Yeah, so when we're talking about a private equity group, so we're thinking the large corporations, things like BlackRock, right? So we're thinking of these companies that will effectively set up separate entities, right? They'll get investors together. They'll set up a separate entity if it is, you know, say it's BlackRock trying to set something up, right? They will set up BlackRock MPVL3, right? And that'll be what they use to go out, take on debt in order to buy a company. And when they buy that company, they will effectively, whatever debt that they had to take on to purchase it, it will become that company's responsibility to pay back down that debt. And so when we're thinking about private equity, oftentimes it is associated with the sort of nefarious behavior because of how they have operated in other sectors, whether that's nursing homes, whether that is how they've sort of plundered newspapers and sort of really damaged the newspaper business. So oftentimes when we're thinking about private equity, and in this instance, we're really concerned about the bad actors in the private equity space.
And for our audience, what we'll link is we did a segment on the nursing home and hospital situation with Bethany McLean when it comes to private equity, and we did it as related to the housing industry. Now we're here to talk about childcare. And the sort of context here is that there is a massive demand across this country for childcare that appears to be unmet right now. There seem to be numbers. I was looking at the care.com survey, just massive numbers of people responded. 65% of people in their survey responded saying they've spent some time on a daycare wait list, with 81% of families juggling multiple wait lists simultaneously and 43% waiting 4 months or longer. How big is this problem right now?
it's always been an issue, right? As we were leading from around, you know, 2008 on through 2019, 2020, we've had these sort of supply issues with childcare, where you've seen workers say that the wages aren't quite enough. And so you will have experienced teachers kind of leaving the childcare industry. But in recent years, kind of during the pandemic, we saw how important childcare was just to a functioning economy, right? When daycare is closed, when schools closed, you had all of these parents sort of scrambling, trying to figure out, okay, what do I do with my child during the day while I'm trying to go to work as well? And a lot of those issues are still lingering, right? Because Congress had its sort of stopgap measures to help fund the childcare industry during the pandemic, but that money has since run out. And I'm not sure what it's like in your area, but even around here, you know, we're trying to put our kids in childcare. Oftentimes we'll say, hey, you know, this, you know, merit school or wherever, this looks like an interesting childcare facility. And you go over there and like, well, we'll have to wait a little bit. Our classes are full. We don't have enough teachers at the moment. And so the demand is there. And what we're seeing is states respond to that demand by trying to fund childcare in a manner that is commensurate with its importance.
And, you know, one of the states you wrote about is Vermont. Tell us a little bit about what Vermont did.
So last year, Vermont had a massive expansion of its childcare subsidy, over $100 million that they invested in the childcare system to do a range of things, right? So one of them is to help assist families with providing additional funds for childcare services, and they increased the threshold for the wages that families would be able to receive that supplemental funding. They also included things to help providers, whether that's in terms of increasing their capacity or increasing their staff, whatever it may be. But they just invest, they sort of have this long-term massive investment in childcare that kind of shows how important and critical the issues become.
Yeah, and you write about how, okay, and this is also in line with the Build Back Better bill, that would have provided a just massive expansion of the sector, but not in ways that you would expect. Like the assumption would be that the expansion of the sector would be exciting to the sort of big players, but it turns out that they maybe secretly lobbied against it behind the scenes.
Yeah. So effectively, what we're kind of worried about, or what advocates have been worried about over the last couple of years, as we've seen, you know, private equity in particular move into childcare. You know, a couple of years ago, it was very, there wasn't as much concern about private equity in this business, right? It seemed that childcare was still something that was losing money. Most childcare providers are, you know, kind of struggling to break even if you're thinking about the mom and pop shops. But largely, you had a couple of really big childcare networks that were often attached to buildings and companies, right? So if you think about any kind of go across the country, you'll probably find a KinderCare, right? Or you'll probably find a Learning Care Group or whatever it may be. Bright Horizons, they're sort of all over the place. When Bright Horizons, of course, is previously owned by Bain Capital and now is a publicly traded company. But as, you know, they were looking for this Build Back Better bill, they were trying to increase like massively the subsidies that they were giving to childcare providers, trying to raise a sort of salary floor for childcare providers. You did have a little bit of pushback saying that, oh, well, for Republicans, they were saying maybe we're going a little bit too far. Maybe we're, you know, putting too much money into this sector. Liberals were arguing that they weren't going far enough. So ultimately, part of it got axed, and they ended up getting a you know, still sizable subsidy for childcare providers, which recently expanded, and they're trying to sort of re-up in this Congress. But the concern now is that if you have too many sort of private equity businesses involved in childcare, then the next time something like this comes up and they try to put guardrails on it, right? Say, so salary floor would maybe prevent a group from saying, oh, you've given us all this money, let's you know, take that money and pay down some of this debt as opposed to actually paying teachers, right? If there's an actual salary floor, then the money will actually have to go towards that salary floor. If these businesses get too big, then they will have the power to fundamentally stop a lot of legislation that would put guardrails on them.
And just to put some numbers to this, so according to your article, four of the top five for-profit childcare companies, KinderCare, Learning Care Group, Goddard School, and Primrose Schools, are controlled by private equity funds. As you mentioned, the other major player, Bright Horizons, was previously controlled by Bain Capital. They now make up 10 to 12% of the market and growing. And their argument would be, and you know, when I read this Dana Goldstein article from 2022, it's kind of tucked into her article. What Bright Horizons will argue, what these other companies will argue, is that, hey, like, we're providing a great service. Like, when we come in, it's sleek, it's clean, it's shiny. We'll give you real-time data about your how your kid is doing and all that. Whereas I think some of the critics of private equity paint a picture saying, like, these are, you know, this is the classic example of, you know, loading these companies up with debt and then running into the ground, which certainly seems true of the nursing home industry. Which of those two narratives is true, or is it more complicated?
I think it's a little more complicated because oftentimes some of the things, and I read that article as well, and I think that one of the things that gets lost is it's not just the private equity companies that have those sort of the newer technologies, right? So say they're sending pictures of your kid regularly. Like my children, one of my daughters is in pre-K now at a daycare, and we get pictures 9, 10, 11 times a day. But it's not, you know, this is not a private equity run facility. So some of these things have kind of become standard practice that they say that they're introducing and kind of having in the space. And I mean, there is some truth to that, right? If you have a larger network where you can try different things, see where different things work, it could produce a decent service. But what we've seen too often is where groups come in, they change things, try to make them standardized across the board. And there's less concern with the individual situation of the families that are currently involved in at the location. Or say that they come in. This is one example. A private equity company came in. They bought a network of childcare facilities, and you know, they sent a letter around. They said, "Hey, we're the new owners. Not much is going to change. We are going to have the children start to wear uniforms after they're 2 years old, and the tuition is going to be increased." And that's the end of the first email that they sent. They sent a subsequent email, maybe about a week later, that was like, "Oh, well, one of our teachers is leaving, and the director is also going to be resigning. We're going to be installing a new area manager." That's the next email. Like, okay, that's fine as well. Another week passes, two more teachers leave, right? Over the course of about 6 months, there was a regular flow of teachers coming, teachers leaving. You started to see more discontent. The tuition was raised about two more times over that course of time, because effectively what they began doing was trying to effectively pay down some of their debts. They had all of the new things. They painted the building. They put up the new sort of motivational posters. But at the same time, they were also engaging in tactics that could be associated with sort of vulture-ish behavior, right? Trying to take as much, you know, drain as many resources as they could from this business.
Now, is that a trend that we're seeing, extrapolating out to the industry as a whole?
What we've seen, right, is the sort of growth of private equity businesses in childcare. And we've seen complaints across states that, oh, well, the services aren't great. We've seen teachers arguing that they've been denied paid leave. There was a settlement, a pretty large settlement, that accused one of the private equity providers of denying the teachers paid leave. So we have seen situations where private equity has come in. The services have declined kind of across the sector, not just in this one location, but sort of across the sector where they've come in. Services have declined. Tuitions have increased. And it's in a lot of ways similar, as you mentioned, right? I imagine when you were doing your nursing home podcast, it was some of those same things. They come in, you know, they paint the building, they make everything look nice and pretty, but the sort of roots of the services, that when you think of child care, that caring for the child part sort of gets left behind as opposed to in favor of a more business level sort of thinking.
Yeah, what was interesting, you know, looking back at that Goldstein article from 2022, she talks about how at that point, from 2020 to 2022, the childcare industry had lost more than 80,000 workers, often to sort of retail or office jobs. And that contributed to the closing of 12,000 programs. I could imagine this maybe have gotten worse because we've seen a pandemic funding cliff for a lot of these programs. What do we know about the state of the industry as a whole right now?
Yeah, the state of the industry is very similar. And one of the reasons why private equity is able to get into the industry is because so many of those, you know, smaller providers, places with one or two childcare facilities in Chantilly, Virginia, or wherever, right? Those places are saying this isn't financially viable for us anymore. And so we would rather sell our company to a private equity firm that would be able to, you know, take it over, run it. Private equity firms like, great, the raw materials are there. We can go ahead and do that. And so that is why this sort of concern that people have at the moment is feels so palpable, because the sector is struggling. The people who have the money and the resources to stay in the sector as they sort of look towards a potential government bailout or something of the sort, right? Large sums of money going into the sector. The people who are able to do that are these private equity companies. And so putting guardrails in sort of legislation at this moment, as opposed to waiting, you know, 5-6 years. If you've seen the sort of exponential growth of, you know, 10-12% in the last 3 years, you have, you know, push that out 5 years, perhaps they now control 18-20% of the sector rather than 10, and reining them in would be much more difficult.
And why is it that with all this demand, so many of these businesses are struggling? Is it because of the cost of getting started in the regulation? Is it because of the labor market? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, for you know, practitioners, for teachers, if you are, you know, working for 8-9 hours a day at a childcare facility, taking care of children, making something like $10 to $12 an hour, or you could say, I can go over to Amazon and I can make $15 an hour, $15 to $20 an hour as a delivery driver. It's a different kind of work, but I'm making more money, right? There's not a lot of resources for teachers in this profession, right? If you think about childcare as a profession, it is difficult to say that they are being paid as the sort of professionals that they are. One of the reasons for that is that the facilities may find it difficult to fund it, because they're saying, well, if we are going to pay you more, then that means we're going to have to charge the families more. So the costs are going to be pushed off on somebody in some way. It's either they're shorting the teachers and the amount that they're getting paid, or the families are, you know, they're driving up the price, and then all of a sudden they can't afford childcare. People are scrambling to find, you know, low-cost, affordable childcare, which is why there's this thought that it needs to be a government intervention in order to sort of stabilize the market, because the sheer economics of it at this moment just feel, you know, deeply untenable.
Yeah, what's fascinating in reading some of these articles that are critical of private equity is one of the arguments I hear is that the private equity firms are sometimes driving up the cost of labor because they're paying more. And then some other articles would say, well, that they're actually, you know, driving their people out and not paying them enough. And I'm like, well, those two things, I mean, maybe there's two different types of phenomena coexisting next to each other. But I find the combination of those things confusing, because if they're actually paying more, in many ways, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think that one of the things is they're paying more in some instances, but that may, so say you're in Washington, D.C., and KinderCare is building a new facility underneath an office building. And they're saying, hey, we're going to pay our practitioners $20 to $25 an hour for their work. You have an older childcare facility down in Southeast DC, and they're not able to pay people as much, but it's the only real childcare provider in that area. But those teachers are like, I can go make $20 to $25 over at KinderCare. And so they you know, go and do it, which is understandable for financial reasons. They need to take care of their families as well, but it leaves the other childcare facility, sort of leaves them in the lurch, leaves the families that are associated with it in trouble, right? And so I think that you're right. There are sort of competing phenomena going on, but it's also the case that there are good actors in any sector and there are bad actors. So you may have some companies that are behaving better, that are paying their workers fairly, that are doing all of these nice things. But the real concern is for those ones that are getting into it for the potential incentive rather than to actually care for children.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, and I want to get to like what an effective government intervention would look like. There's one part of this that I'm wondering, which is, I wonder if maybe one of the effective, you know, it seems like we need a couple of solutions here at the table. One of them could be maybe less private equity, more just scaled companies and nonprofits that aren't operating under the private equity model, which is very debt laden and has often, you know, the critique is that I share of private equity often is that their thinking is very short term, whereas Bright Horizon going to publicly traded actually in some ways is probably a very positive development, because it now has, you know, it's beholden to its shareholders, but at least now it's not operating under the private equity model. So, you know, perhaps more companies operating like that could be helpful.
Yeah, I think, you know, if under that model, you would think in terms of, I think one of the issues with private equity is that they're not thinking of a long-term sustainability of the company, right? And if it's a publicly traded company, you would like, if you're investing in it, you would like your investment to you know, if this is something you want to buy and hold on to, something that seems like a safe investment for the long-term, you know, they may operate under different, you know, business principles and practices in that case. And so there are still, as you mentioned, right, there's still Elliot Haspel from Capital, who I interviewed, has an interesting policy paper on this, where he looks at sort of investor-backed companies. So not just the private equity companies, but investor-backed companies generally. So that includes the publicly traded companies. And he does mention that there's still these sort of concerns around those publicly traded companies, but there are less concerns about them than private equity. And so I do think that could be a sustainable model, but I also, you know, and this is kind of the case with education more broadly. I've often just thought that we should view these things as a public good. The reason why we private equity ends up getting into a business like this, the reason why cost of care continues to go up is because it's like, well, if you are a family, you're trying to go to work to make money for your family. So you probably need to get the money together to send your kid to childcare, as opposed to we as a collective need to take care of children because those early development years are incredibly important for a long-term success for that child, which means that we're going to be building more engaged and responsible citizens down the road, right? It's a more collective experience of what childcare can be as opposed to that sort of private experience of it. And so the more that we move towards thinking in a public good model, I think the better off we would be.
Yeah, what's so fascinating to me about that, and maybe at some point I'll have I should probably have a private equity person on, or at least private equity friendly person on this podcast, because this is, I'm trying to synthesize like across issues now. We've now done healthcare, we've done childcare, and then we did housing. And what's interesting is on the housing context, what private equity will say is, all right, they'll always say it's exaggerated, right? They'll always be like, you know, it's not, we don't have a large market share. And then the people, critics of private equity will be like, well, what's the latest trend? Like each year, what percentage of activity is coming from private equity? Are they growing or not? And usually, you know, those two data sets present very different pictures. But what they'll say about housing is, look, you know, we're going into low-income neighborhoods and buying and fixing these things up and actually making it more hospitable to renters. And maybe the homeowners will hate us, but you know, we're, you know, improving the rental situation, and who else is going out there and doing this work, right? This is what they'll say. And they'll say, okay, if you look at this childcare, you look at this when it comes to nursing homes and, you know, buying and fixing up houses in more distressed neighborhoods, nobody, you know, we wouldn't be here if there were a lot of people trying to do it. There just aren't a lot of people trying to do it. That's their argument, I would think. I mean, I'm making their argument up for them, but this at least seems to be common across the different domains when you read about the sort of defenders of private equity.
Yeah, no, that is effectively the argument, right? We are doing a service, right? This building was old. This business was going out of business, right? Toys R Us was struggling. Borders was struggling, and so we had to go in and sort of save it. But in certain businesses, so in the case of Toys R Us, in the case of Borders, it's sort of they were pushed to the point of, you're sort of stretched to the point of breaking, right? There was only so much tension that it could take, the company could take financially before it was going to break and say, well, we need to go bankrupt. I think that, and I don't want it to seem like, you know, private equity equals bad, right? Yeah, I think that can often be how the conversation can be misconstrued. There are things that private businesses can do to inject funds and get out and be like, okay, well, we've done a good job. You know, Bright Horizons, Bain got out, they got their money, and now Bright Horizons is a, you know, rather thriving business, right? And their schools, you know, were pretty consistently rated pretty well. But the issue comes in when they're, you know, they don't have a responsibility or any liability, right? So say a child dies at a child care facility, they can likely skirt liability for that. And so it's not that all private equity is bad. It's that private equity, like any other business, should have some skin in the game and some responsibility. Otherwise, there's nothing to prevent those nefarious actors from those negative incentives.
Yeah, an example you gave in your article is this woman, Annie Sally, who's a resident of a nursing home that was purchased by a private equity group, Carlyle, like big, big private equity group. She died after an injury she sustained while going to the bathroom. When she tried to sue, her family tried to sue Carlyle. A judge dismissed the case because they said that Carlyle actually didn't own the firm. It was owned by Carlyle Partners MVCLP. What? So they're creating these sort of shell companies. I don't know enough to know, like, this might be above all of our pay grades, but how do they get, so they create these shell companies. How do these shell companies get the ability to take out debt? Is Carlyle, like, basically doing what your parents do when you're buying a house? Like, is it just, are they saying we've got you covered and somehow that doesn't create a chain of ownership or custody?
So Carlyle will set up this fund, this separate sort of fund that they're advising. So they were like, oh, we manage this fund, and they will get other investors to plug into it, kind of like you're investing in a mutual fund, right? So you're just saying, Carlyle, here's this money. I heard you were buying this business. Fantastic. And so they create this this sort of seed capital that they need, and they use the fact that they have collected this collateral to take on this debt to buy the companies, to buy the buildings, whatever it is. Kind of from that point, that fund becomes the sort of sole shareholder. But really, they say they operate as an advisor. And because the company has been saddled with so much debt, if a family says, okay, we're going to sue.
There are no assets.
We don't have any assets. Yeah, exactly. We don't have a building.
And they're secured probably too, right? So like the assets are probably attached to the loan. Anything they own would be given to the debt holders. That's so fascinating. The big question then is what's the solution? Because one thing that's lurking over all of this is a lot of these companies, even the most successful ones, aren't serving the lowest income. And maybe in a lot of cases, not even middle income. It's just very expensive. The data from care.com is eye-opening. So they talk about how this is their most recent survey. They said HHS states that childcare is considered affordable when it costs families no more than 7% of their household income. Yet on average, according to the care survey, respondents are spending 24% of their household income on childcare versus, and then 60% are spending 20% or more, 84% are spending 10% or more. So 84% of people are above the threshold of affordable childcare. Right now, the numbers are wild if you look at just what it costs for this kind of stuff. And it's honestly like a lot of people who say, you know, underpopulation, which is a big conversation happening in this country right now, we're not having enough kids, yada, yada, yada. Most people of my generation, you know, people having kids, your generation, cost is a major issue. Like people are like, I live in New York City. Having a kid is an insanely expensive proposition.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's one of the things that people factor in. They're like, can we afford a child, right? That's the very first thing that you think about. Like, how are we actively going to afford this? If I have to go to work every day, if you sort of look across the lower sort of end of the spectrum in terms of how much childcare is costing in a place like, you know, the DC area, you're probably at the minimum going to pay somewhere between $1,500 to $1,900. And that's for the sort of lower end of the spectrum. You sort of move up, you have the places with bigger wait lists. And so that cost is a huge issue. I think when you think about the sort of the solutions to fix that, it does look like a government intervention, because outside of private equity, outside of sort of private individuals, not a lot of people have enough money to fix the issue sort of in terms of making it more affordable, which is why everyone is looking towards the government to fix it. And you were mentioning kind of what could some of those fixes look like. They could look like a salary floor. They could look like just larger government investment in, you know, upgrading facilities and businesses. Maybe it's a supplement to families that's not just a tax credit at the end of the year, but that can sort of be applied, you know, throughout the year as a sort of preemptive thing to say, okay, each month, this family with three kids gets $1,500 to help supplement that cost to make it a little bit more affordable. But as they're doing that, they should also consider ways to prevent people from getting into the industry just because it looks like a cash cow.
Yeah, one interesting idea, Wisconsin, I don't know the details, but they were trying to sort of deregulate in some ways that were trying to empower more sort of smaller startups. And I wonder, you know, my sort of libertarian friends are always worried about regulatory capture within a space like this is real. Like, let's say you and I wanted to start a childcare company in New York. Like, the first thing people are going to say is, oh my God, the cost of even just getting through the lawyers and all this kind of stuff is prohibitive. But if you're Bright Horizon, you got a team of lawyers, you know exactly how to do it. You're going to get that license pretty quickly. I wonder if states can invest in processes. It could be deregulation, or it could just be fast-tracked for the small mom and pops. It could be subsidizing the costs of startup for mom and pop shops. The big players will hate this and lobby against all this, but it would definitely help increase demand, and it would increase it would create way more small businesses and companies that are operating under standard small business economics and not big corporate private equity economics.
I think that's really smart. And sort of getting inventive in ways to sort of streamlining the process so that the overhead for starting up isn't as difficult.
And train people, right? What if New York had maybe they have this and I don't know about it, like a childcare startup? Because I did this for charter schools, right? I got a fellowship from an organization called Building Excellent Schools. They took me around. They taught me like how to create great schools. I then got a grant to start my first school. I had a technical support team that helped me get through the process of getting approved and all this kind of stuff. Like, I wonder if states could be creating versions of this for, you know, like you talk about people who are working in the industry. Like, all right, like, let's grab that person, put them through a year-long fellowship. And then now they're like given the stamp of approval for the state. Say this person went through, if they apply for a license, we're going to be way more likely to approve it than anybody else. And we're going to do it faster than anybody else because they've been through this program.
Yeah, no, I think that's sharp. And they have the fundamentals of how the sort of best practices for how programs work, how programs should be run. I think that would be very sharp. In addition to, the Wisconsin bill that you were talking about, it increased their tax credit as well.
It didn't pass, though, right?
There was one that passed. Was it 2 days ago?
Just 2 days ago. Okay.
Yeah. So it was very recent, and the governor vetoed a tax cut package, but ultimately ended up signing the expanded tax credit into law. And it moves the thresholds up from $525. To $3,500 for a single dependent, $1,000 to $7,000 for multiple dependents. And so it's like, you know, in the same way that I was saying $1,500 a month potentially for a family, this is a good way at the back end to say, hey, if you're paying this money now, but that money is going to come back to you. And I think having that sort of guarantee, knowing that those funds are going to be there for a lot of families, is going to make a huge difference.
Well, okay, Adam, thank you so much for being with us today. This was great. We'll keep an eye on this. Like, this whole world of private equity and all aspects of American life, especially education, there's a whole other world that I'm aware of now in the K-12 space of private equity, especially in the world of ESAs and all that kind of stuff. And I don't claim to know a lot about that. I imagine you probably have it sitting on your list of things to examine over the next couple of years. But I'm fascinated by that world too, just because people I know from the education sector who've been starting education startup companies and all that, a lot of them seem to have an eye on acquisition, which is a whole other dynamic, by the way, that people start. It has a huge effect on the market early on, even from the people who aren't PE, because people then are like, all right, they're almost positioning themselves to get acquired by PE.
Yeah. So effectively starting the school or starting the company just to say that, okay, in the future, this is going to happen.
Sure. I had a call with a guy in North Carolina not too long ago who was starting a school there that in part was going to get ESA dollars. And he openly admitted that the goal would be to be acquired eventually.
Interesting.
Yeah. Brave new world we're in, Adam. Where can folks find you and your work other than the pages of The Atlantic?
I'm on all socials at Adam H. Says, and my personal website, just harrisadam.com.
Great. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. We'll be right back here on Tuesday. Thank you very much, everybody.